Today, my guest is an outspoken libertarian, the author of two books titled The Populist Deception and How to Talk to a Progressive have made her an international sensation. With no plans of slowing down, she's getting ready to chase her biggest dream, becoming president of Guatemala. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Gloria Alvarez. Gloria, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Very happy to be here with you and your audience.
I'm excited. So before we move forward, why don't you tell us a little bit more about you and your background?
Yes, I live in Mexico City. I'm originally from Guatemala. My family is a little bit from all over the place. My dad is from Cuba, and my mom is half Hungarian and half Guatemalan. So yeah, I pretty much was brought up with the notion of the dangers of totalitarian regimes, especially of the communist type, since my family both suffered the Soviet imposition in Hungary, as well as the Castro regime in Cuba.
You were very outspoken about all those issues in a very early age. But at what point you decided, you know what, if no one is really talking about that, I will.
Well, the thing is that I also had the fortune of studying in a very libertarian university in Guatemala. And I didn't choose the university for that reason, but because it was the only one in my country offering the career that I wanted to study, which was international affairs and political science. But the good thing about it is that I could study a perspective about Austrian economics, about the importance of limited government, which made perfect sense as a rational solution for the things that I've been hearing all my life since I was young that my family suffered. So for me, it was like, okay, these are the ideas that should be, you know, taken into account whenever we are voting or whenever we are sick of a regime. Sadly, in Latin America, even though people are super disappointed with governments, always the solution is more government to power.
Have you noticed a shift? Have you seen the younger generation kind of moving away from that approach?
I think that for the majority of people, they now understand in Latin America after the failure of socialism of the 21st century, because you have to understand that when Hugo Chavez came to power, it was like the new hope. It was like a new revival of the Cuban regime. And they told us that Caracas was going to be like the city where everyone wanted to migrate and live. And of course, from 1988 till now, that has been exactly opposite of the case, right? Almost more than 4 million Venezuelans have fled the country. And socialism of the 21st century not only was a huge failure, but it's also responsible for the most multi-billionaire corruption case of Latin American history, which is Odebrecht. So now people understand that the left wing failed to them. They also know that the right wing obsolete conservatism that took place pretty much during the entire 20th century through military regimes is also not the solution. So now libertarians like myself are not seen as these crazy radicals who are, you know, proposing separating economics from the states or education from the state. But still, for the majority of people, this is not quite a solution. They still think that government should control the economies. And the battle of ideas is now, you know, taking place into that account.
Not only in Latin America, but you can see all over the world that there has been a big trend of governments going to the far right. And then we find ourselves debating between being too liberal or too conservative. Is that how we are going to conduct politics in the next decade?
No, sadly, I think it's a pendulous move. It's like a pendulous, and it all already happened in Latin America. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, most of Latin American countries voted far right. And these far right governments proposed free market, but instead, in reality, they inputted very mercantilist economies. And because of in the 90s, these far right governments did bring a little bit of, you know, economic openness and there was more progress than ever in the region, people were very upset. And when they got upset, then they moved the pendulums all the way to socialism of the 21st century. So now that this has failed, they move back again the pendulums. And the sad thing, not only in Latin America, but with the cases of, you know, Trump and the far right and Bolsonaro, is that people think that what they should do is punish their leaders by voting for their complete opposite. They don't understand that this irrational way of voting only at the end affect themselves, because they move from one extreme to the other extreme. But these two extremes, they always annihilate freedoms. The left wing annihilates economic freedoms, and the far right also annihilates economic freedoms because it becomes crony capitalism. Only business and markets for the peers of the president in power. And this also upsets people. And both extremes also don't like other freedoms, like freedom of expression, freedom of the press, even sexual freedoms. Because even if the left likes to grab some causes like, you know, sexual diversity or ecologic, in practice, they also violate these essential freedoms in humanity. So for me, it's like, it's sad that the answer to one extreme is always going to another extreme. I don't think this is something new. It's something that in our region is the way it has always been. Maybe it's newer in the United States and in Europe, where institutions have been, you know, more stable, stronger to limit powers. And now we're seeing how these institutions have weakened themselves, giving, you know, the door open to new, you know, actors that are not politicians like Donald Trump.
Now, you travel all over the place and you talk about this quite intensely. Have you noticed or seen any government or any country or even smaller cities that has adopted the perfect balance, something that's cohesive, that is making sense for the citizens and the free market as well?
Well, you know, for me, the best way to analyze that as a solution is when you look at, there are three indexes, world indexes that range a lot of different data, and they go from economic freedom, which is the Heritage Foundation and the Fraser Institute Index of Economic Freedom. These are two different indexes that you can, you know, look, and you will see how much property rights are respected in a country, how easy it is to make contracts, how easy is it to start a business, how many corruption do you have to get involved with in order to start a business, and that kind of thing. And when you look at the Index of Economic Freedoms from both of these institutions, you will find that the poorest in the most free countries are 11 times more rich than the poorest in the least free countries, as well as the poorest in the most rich countries or open and open to free market, they tend to live 13 more years of life than the poorest in the most closed country. So if you're a poor person, it is better for you to live in a way more open economic society, because your chances of getting out of poverty will increment, in the sense that you will have more options to start a business, to migrate, to make contracts with other countries, etc. Now, there's another index that is, for me, as important as the economic freedom, because you can also have authoritarian capitalism, which I don't like, and I don't think it's necessary. This is like China, right? You have all the free economic of the world, but you don't have basic human rights. You cannot even Google words like freedom or democracy or stuff like that. So there's another index, and this is the Human Index Freedom in the World. And it's made by the Cato Institute. And what this index measures is how free are you to be an atheist or to have certain religion that is not the official religion of your country? How free are you to be a woman, to be a homosexual, to express your ideas, to have free media, etc., etc.? So for me, the countries that have the higher scores in economic freedom and human freedom are the ones that approach themselves more to the model that I support. This given to say that I'm not looking for perfection. I'm not looking for utopias. Whoever wants a utopia should stick with socialism, because that's the ideology that promises you a paradise on earth where no one is corrupt. What I'm looking for is the least worst system, because humanity is corruptible. And the only thing that makes us least corrupt is when the laws incentivize us to be more efficient and good than to be, perverse. So for me, it's all about a system where if you are free, there's nothing guaranteed that you will make the perfect decisions or the right choices for your life. It only guarantees you that no one else will choose for you, that at least you have the guarantee that you are choosing for yourself. That's the only thing about freedom.
So in your opinion, what should the government be responsible?
For me, there's only two major tasks that the government should do, and this is security and justice. As long as there is security and justice, you can guarantee equality of opportunity. Because for me, equality of opportunity can only be possible when there is rule of law, when we are all equal under the law. When you are not equal under the law, then the rules of the game are not the same for everyone, especially for the poor. The poor always get fucked by the rich, because the rich can always bribe the authorities to get out of the legislation. Whereas even if the poor are innocent, they rotten in jail because they don't have the means to bribe authorities. So if there's no rule of law, if there's no equality under the law, and the law treats you exactly the same, even if you are Bill Gates or the guy that picks up the trash, then you won't have a country that has equality of opportunities. Because when you have justice, what you are guaranteeing your citizens is their three basic human rights, which are their right to their life, their right to their property, to the private property they acquire through their own job and effort, and their right to their freedoms, all of their freedoms. For me, that's like the standard base. And for you to have that, you need an efficient police force that is well paid in order not to receive bribes. You need judges that are impartial and cannot be corrupted, that are obedient to the law and not to the crony capitalists of the moment. You need a jail system that is actually efficient, instead of creating more criminals, that it reestablishes people in society. So for me, as long as there's an efficient line of security and justice, then you can leave everything else to the market, which means having options. Options that go from charity, because if you really want to help the poor and the elderly and the little kids and the pets and whatever cause you want to get involved with, then if you really care for that cause, do it with your own money. Do it with your own time. Don't expect the government to do the things that you wouldn't do with your own means, right? So for me, it's all about giving the diversity of options so people can acquire private health, cheap or super expensive, charity health, which is what happens in Guatemala. We have a disastrous health system of the state. So what happens? You have all these associations, private associations, that take care of cancer, HIV, diabetes, kids that are blind, kids that are deaf. And thanks to those private associations, poor people can have access to health that otherwise they don't have, neither in the state health, neither in the private hospitals. The same with education. I don't care that you pay taxes for education. as long as there's a voucher system implemented where the parents can decide where they can send their kids to school. Aside from those things, I don't think the government should get involved in anything else.
So for those people who make an argument that maybe the environment can become a situation of a national security, do you buy that argument?
I do believe that we are being super irresponsible with the oceans. It's undeniable the amount of plastic and trash and the amount of cruelty in which we treat the nature of this world. And I actually blame a little bit religion for that, because religion implements the message that humans are above and beyond the rest of nature. And this obstructs the thinking that as humans, we are part of this ecosystem, we are part of evolution, and since we are the most rational beings, we should take the lead into taking care of the environment. That said, I think that the market provides way more efficient solutions for the environmental issues that we have than any government or bureaucratic office. For instance, the Tesla cars or the streets made with plastic or the eco filter in Guatemala, which filters water with minerals, solutions that come from the individuals that actually are worried about what the environment happens, and they put these solutions in the market for other individuals to, you know, approach it. I also believe that the problem with ecological issues is a matter of property rights. When something is not owned by anyone, then everyone pollutes it. So what we need is property rights on our trash, so we start being accountable for the things we dispose as our private property. And we also need private rights in the seas. So because you look at it in the beaches, I have been in beaches that are full of plastic in Belize, in Honduras, in Guatemala. And what happens? The parts that are from no one are polluted with plastic. The parts that are from a hotel or a house are completely clean, because we tend to take care of the things that are our own.
So do you think national parks like Yellowstone, you would be better off if it was privatized?
Well, I mean, as long as if you're seeing that in Yellowstone, there starts a problem of fires, of extinction of some species. Like if you see that under the state, there is no accountability for taking care of the environment, then yeah, you should analyze the solution of privatizing. Whenever you see a problem, I am also very pragmatical in the sense if it's not broken, don't fix it. But if you're seeing a problem, why stick with the same solution? That's insanity, right? That's what Albert Einstein used to say, right? You cannot expect different things if you're always doing the same thing.
On the justice side, to make sure that everybody's treated equally, from Bill Gates to anybody else, I think it's very important that we keep money outside politics. And that's very difficult because, as you know, election year, not only in the United States, anywhere in the world, generates a lot of money. There's a lot of people pursuing their own ambitions. So what's the solution here? How do you get money out of politics?
No, actually, I believe that there shouldn't be any lobbies, any super PACs, any of that. What I do believe is that if you have a private way of solving issues in between contracts, businesses, or even nations, use them. It's fine. Arbitrary solutions can enter the competition of the judicial system in a state, and that should be allowed. But I don't believe that there should be any lobbies pushing for any economic measures in a nation. As a company, what you should be focusing on is having the best product for your consumers and hope that they will choose you from other competitors, right?
But a lot of times the argument they make is that they also pay taxes, so they also have the right to be heard.
Of course, but they pay taxes that nowadays go to the lobbies of a system that has the government involved in economics. As Yaron Brooks says, I think that it would be a great idea to put in the U.S. Constitution the absolute separation of economics and the state. So then when you pay taxes, you know that those taxes are in no way contributing to manipulate the economic system of your country, but that they exclusively go to security and justice, and then economics is completely separated. But the thing is that we live in a world where we don't want to separate a state from economics. So all these companies, of course, use the excuse of, you see, I'm paying taxes, so I have rights of demanding privileges for myself.
Well, it's definitely a very important topic that we need to continue to discuss. Well, let's talk a little bit about Mexico. Now that you're living there, how do you see the situation in the country?
Well, Mexico has suffered a very polarized year because, like Trump did in the US, López Obrador did here. Families are completely divided in, you know, supporting the new president or hating him. I'm quite concerned because this guy is part of the club of the socialism of the 21st century. He hasn't gotten into power and he already canceled a multimillionaire project of making a new airport for Mexico City. So we are already seeing devaluation of the currency. In Mexico, I work for a media company called Grupo Salinas. I produce TV shows, but they also give me all the freedom to keep up my work in all Latin America, Europe, and now Asia. I'm flying to Hong Kong to give a conference in the Libertarian Lion Rock Institute to talk about how education in Latin America is completely manipulated to make the kids and the young people praise socialism, right? So I'm also working on a third book. For people that don't know, I wrote a first book with a libertarian economist from Chile, which is called The Populist Deceit. What we did in this book is like an analysis of Latin American governments, especially the ones of socialism of the 21st century. So we're talking about Venezuela, Ecuador, Cuba, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, which are El Salvador, which are all countries that voted for this kind of regime. In my second book, which is called How to Talk to a Progressive or How to Talk to a Leftist, I gathered all the experience that I have had debating with young communists and young socialists of all Latin America. And now I'm working on my third book that will come out next year. It's called How to Talk to a Conservative. Why, instead of increasing it, conservatism is obstructing liberties in our societies. So what I want to do with these two books is finally differentiating the libertarian movement from the socialist economics, but also from the conservative morality that tries to implement one way of living as the only correct one. Those are the things that I'm currently working on.
Now, here in the U.S., in the last couple of elections, we keep hearing more and more about what they call democratic socialism. Now, the word socialism has always had a very bad connotation. Do you think it is dangerous to use that word when we talk about a political party in the United States, or it doesn't really matter?
I think it's another word for the same old ideas, because as Ayn Rand used to say about communism and socialism, she says, communism and socialism is the same thing. In one, you get killed without your, you know, your will. In the other one, you vote in order to get killed. It's the same difference in between assassination and suicide. At the end, I think that whenever I have asked people, you know, what's the difference between communism and socialism? Let's start with that, right? So if we go to Karl Marx, even Marx said, everything before annihilating the state, annihilating private property, and annihilating money, everything before that stage is socialism. Communism is only acquired once you don't have state, once you don't have money, and once you don't have private property. Nowhere in the world where communism has tried to be implemented, this has been the case. Instead of eliminating the state got bigger, a totalitarian dictatorship. We saw it with Stalin, we saw it with Mao, we saw it with Castro, etc. Never private property is eliminated. Private property only becomes a privilege of the ones in power. And of course, money has never been eliminated. Money also becomes a privilege of the ones in power. So if we go strictly to the theory, everything that we have had in the world, according to Marx, has only been socialism. Now, if we only have had socialism, what is democratic socialism? Well, democratic socialism seems to be the difference in between a regime inputting itself by force, like the Bolshevik Revolution or Castro Revolution or Mao Revolution, versus when you vote for the socialist guy, like it happened in Venezuela, in Brazil, and with all these presidents of socialism of the 21st century. So if the only difference is if you're voting for the regime or the regime is imposed by force, that doesn't mean there's a difference in the economic policies that take into place.
Do you believe in minimum wage?
No, I don't believe. In fact, I think, for example, Scandinavia, which is one of the models that they try to sell us as socialists, they don't even have a minimum wage, and they have higher wages than anywhere in Latin America. Switzerland, 2 years ago, voted against a basic minimum income for people who didn't even work. And I believe that minimum wage, the only thing that makes is it leaves people out of employment, because it's an arrogant idea of believing that you know better how much people want to earn. Like, if someone wants to work for 5 cents a day, why shouldn't they be allowed to do so if they don't have any other choice? So I believe that this also makes informal economy huge. For instance, in Guatemala, informal economy is 80%, which means that from 10 people that are part of the economic activities, only 2 idiots pay taxes. Other 8 don't pay 1 tax. And of course, in the informal economy, it doesn't matter if you're earning the minimum wage or not, because no one is watching, right?
Okay, so I like to be proactive. So let's think about this. In 30, 40 years, more likely we're going to have a big shift on the workforce with automation and all the new technologies that's coming up. There has been a serious conversation about basic universal income. Number one, what do you think about that? And 2, who should be responsible for that? Is that the government responsibility to retrain and provide decent living to its citizens? Or the private company should bear some of the responsibilities as well? How do we go about that?
Well, Yuri, let me tell you some theory that I have that I, of course, don't have any data to prove. This is not something that I can, with evidence proof.
Okay.
But it's something that has been on my mind. I think that overpopulation is something that has happened also because people are not accountable for their children. I think that due to socialist policies, due to the increment of the welfare state, due to this idea that governments should take care of your kids, of your elders, of your education, of your health, this has made people to reproduce themselves even more and more and more. I don't believe that we would be right now 7 billion human beings if we would have all be left alone and accountable for ourselves in a free market system. How do I perceive this? Because the poorest countries have way more kids, and the richest countries tend to be more responsible of bringing less children to the world. So I believe that now we are all, you know, worried about machines taking over and what are we going to do with all these human beings that won't have work. Well, I really hope that when these machines come in, instead of having more government inside economics, we leave it to the forces of the spontaneous order so we can have an equilibrium in the amount of human beings that are getting born in this world.
But let's be honest, we know for a fact too that the main reason why that happens is because they don't have access to contraception or they're not educated about it. And even for religious reasons, there's more to it than just accountability.
Absolutely, Yuri, absolutely. These are all satellites of the same moon, of the same planet. Religion. The fact that you cannot talk about sex education, the fact that there's conservatism is all supported by governments that implement socialism because socialism feeds from poor and ignorant voters. The more ignorant and poor your voter is, the cheaper it is for you as a politician to buy their votes. If someone is autonomous, intelligent, and critical, then you cannot bribe them to vote for you with a chicken or a bag of food. So you are interested in maintaining the people in poverty and ignorance and reproducing themselves constantly. But if you would leave the spontaneous order to work, this wouldn't be the case. And let me give you an example. The abortion ship that is from Holland and goes around the world offering free abortions as a charity, a private charity, they went to Guatemala and they were in international waters and there was a line of women who wanted to get an abortion because in Guatemala, abortion is illegal. The military, the church, the government, and the conservative groups all united in order to kick out the ship. Immediately there, you are condemning women, and not only women, little girls, to become mothers. So I believe that if you would leave the forces of the market and of the free society to, you know, enter these conservative socialist countries, then you would see a decrease in the amount of people getting born.
When you are in the United States and you watch the news here talking about the issues in Latin America and what's going on in other countries like Mexico, Guatemala, and etc., do you feel they have a clear vision of what's going on? Is that a fair representation? They're doing good reporting or is just more of an exaggeration?
Well, it depends. It depends on the American that you're speaking with. I love, for example, when Americans go to Guatemala and they understand that what we need is jobs. We need trade, nor aid. When they look at how people do have a discipline of working. People get up early. They go, working for 8 hours, 10 hours sometimes. Like when people travel, they open their eyes. But if you are an American that from America are seeing the rest of the world, your scope of it is going to be what you see on the media, what you see, you know, on liberal media, most of all. And you're going to think that the way of helping us is by, you know, giving aid and charity. And that is just proven that it doesn't work. So what I would recommend for Americans is get a grasp of it. Like, if you think socialism works, go to Venezuela, go to Nicaragua, compare it to the policies implemented by Karl Marx. See if there's any difference. I mean, good intentions are not enough for good policies.
Well, my wife is probably tired of hearing me saying that the world is full of good intentions, but that doesn't mean good things are going to come out of it.
Exactly.
Now, have you ever thought about getting in politics at all?
Yeah, I actually have a plan. I've never been in politics. I've never been part of a party. I've been offered everything that you can imagine because...
I imagine.
Yeah. Since I have a lot of people that follow me, politicians are interested in having me on their side, but I've never agreed because I'm a libertarian. So not the right wing and of course not the left wing offer me the space to actually implement the ideas that I think will be necessary. In my country, you have to be 40 years old in order to present yourself as a candidate for the presidency. I'm 33 right now. So my plan when I'm 40 is that I'm going to make a video and I'm going to establish 5 principles that are non-negotiable. Like if you vote for me, these 5 things will definitely happen. And if you don't want it, then don't even bother to vote for me, because I won't, you know, like I don't want power just for having power. I want power to do the things that I think are right. I might be wrong, but at least it's something.
Yes, but if you do that, you're going to become an extremist as well.
Yeah, of course, but at least there's the offer. I mean, what I'm going to do, like I'm going to offer.
Take it or leave it.
Take it or leave it. Is these five things non-negotiable? And then I'm going to give 10 other things for people to choose other five. From those 10 things, I can live with or without, but it would be an opportunity for Guatemala to modernize itself. So in those 10 things, I would put things like gay marriage, legalizing abortion, legalizing marijuana, legalizing the privatization of adoptions, et cetera, et cetera. Things that are more about civil rights. In the five things that are non-negotiable, it's more about like economic policies and the administration of the state.
Okay, so you have five things that's crucial to you that's non-negotiable. And the other five items, you would let the public decide what's important. And that would be your overall campaign.
Yes. And no political campaign at all, because right now I'm quite known in Guatemala. So part of my campaign will be the first ecological campaign in history. There won't be no flyers, no moopies, no, how do you call it in English? Like the big ads that like you
billboards, billboards.
Yeah. Billboards, nothing. Like all my campaign is this video. And then I would have explanatory videos of each policy if people, you know, want to understand how the education voucher works or how am I going to implement free trade zones, et cetera, et cetera. But my platform, like what I want to do is that if it works, well, it worked. And if not, it's fine. Like I'm not obsessed. I don't believe that my life will be a failure because I didn't become president of Guatemala. I will try it. I guess that we have had killers as presidents. We have had people who even have speech impediments. We have had people with not even high school degrees as presidents. So why not, you know?
I guess the big question is how you're going to fund the campaign. It's going to be donations only from your supporters, or are you going to find different ways to raise money? Because as you know, elections cost a lot of money.
Elections do cost money when you are not known. But the thing is that because of all the work that I've been doing for the past, because yeah, I got famous internationally in 2014, but I've been working spreading libertarian ideas in Guatemala from 2010. So from 2010 to 2020 is going to be one decade. By the moment that I'm 40, it's going to be almost two decades of people knowing my work. So I think that will diminish the costs for me to, you know, not have to get involved with like a crony businessman to give me money. Because that's the other thing. In Latin America, if you receive money for your campaign, you immediately are compromising something. No one gives you money for nothing in return. And the only ones interested in my kind of government are the outcasts, the pot smokers, the little business that get fucked by big business, the prostitutes, the indigenous women who get abused. You know what I mean? Like my government would be the government of the outcasts. And that's the only way of, you know, like keeping outcasts together is with a cohesive plan that doesn't involve a lot of money, I guess.
So it's a 4-year term for president in Guatemala?
It is a 4-year term and there's elections in 2019. So it would be like in 2 or 3 more elections.
Yeah. Well, it's coming up soon.
Yeah.
It's coming up soon. Now it's the part that I usually ask our guests to recommend a book to our listeners. Do you have one in mind?
Well, yeah, actually I have, talking about, you know, law and legislation, for me, the best book, if you want to start from scratch, is The Law by Frederic Bastiat. I think that book is like the most explanatory of what the law should and shouldn't be. And then another book that I would also recommend anyone who manages money is Economics in One Lesson from Henry Hazlitt. I think that if you're starting from zero, go through that. And also I'm getting involved in neuroscience because I think that now neuroscience is giving us clues of why are we wired to be free individuals. And on this, I would recommend Steven Pinker, The Blank Slate. I would recommend Sapiens, which is an excellent book. Right now, I don't have the author's name. And also Cosmos by Carl Sagan.
No, we had a Dr. Simon here. She's a neuroscientist at the podcast, and it was a great podcast. There's a lot of information, and definitely a field of science is very exciting right now, and there's a lot of new things coming up.
Well, just to add this, I mean, let's remember that when Karl Marx wrote, psychology, psychoanalysis was not even in existence. So I understand that the guy could make the case of arguing that we could actually be selfless and, you know, abandon our self-esteem and our own dreams. But now that we have all this information, we do understand that neurologically, we are wired to have a self-esteem and a self-interest and to take care of our own personal interest in order to provide benefits for society.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard here first, Gloria Álvarez for president of Guatemala in 2027.
Thank you.
Let everybody know how they can engage with you, follow on social media, and how they can find you online.
Yes, please. I'm in Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube as Gloria Álvarez. There I am, and soon I will have a webpage as well. And also, there are a lot of conferences, also some works in English. I worked with John Stossel, with Prager University. I also was in CPAC and the European Parliament. So there's a couple of my works in English. Most of it is in Spanish, but there are still things in English.
Ladies and gentlemen, Gloria Álvarez. Gloria, thank you very much.
Thank you, Yuri. I loved your questions. This was very fun.
Hey everyone, make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.